The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Okay, no business news tonight. Ian Guider is off this week, but it gives us time to spend a lot of time talking about the best sports books of 2019 that you might want to buy for yourself or you might want to buy for somebody else as a present. And not only are we going to talk about the books, but we have clips of interviews of some of those authors of the books. So over the course of the next hour, you'll be hearing bits from Warren Gatland, Owen Larkin, Michael Owen, Richie Sadlier, Donald McRae and Adrian Russell. And to go through the books here, Niamh Briggs, I think this is your third or fourth year, former Irish Rugby International doing this. So thank you very much, Niamh, for being back with us. And Michael Foley, Sunday Times sports writer, who was with us last year as well. Can we talk about Joe Schmidt first? Because, Niamh, this is the book which is already, looks like it was selling not only every sports book, but every other book. Now, you've only read extracts so far, I believe.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance. There's a big list this year, so we're trying to get through them all. And
it came very late to the list.
It did, in fairness. It did come very late. And I don't think anybody was really expecting it, as far as I know. None of the players were expecting it either. Look, he obviously has a huge draw because of the huge success the rugby team have had over the last 3 or 4 years, albeit, not very well defined by the World Cups. But there's also an elusiveness to Joe. He doesn't do many interviews, so you feel like that you pick it up because you want to get to know the man. And he's incredibly endearing in person, as you know. Ridiculously intelligent in terms of his rugby knowledge, but also his knowledge about books and literature and everything like that. So
level of expectation.
Yeah, it did.
But you've read of it, I know you're going to sit down and read it in full. You've read extracts. Has the extracts encouraged you that this is a book that you're looking forward to?
No, not really. Just in the sense that for me, you're always looking for something new. So every sports book you pick up, you're looking for something new from that author or the sports person. And it was kind of what I already knew so far. And it's just a lot of... I'd love to have delved a little bit closer into him as a person. For somebody coming from New Zealand who started off as a teacher and then becomes the Irish rugby coach, the story in itself is brilliant, but I don't think we really get that.
Michael Foley, you've started it, I believe.
Yeah, I got through the prologue and I paused at that point for the time being.
Why?
Well, even after the prologue, you're getting the sense of... Well, the prologue essentially starts out with some people from New Zealand who knew him contacting some people in Ireland to find out, is this the same Joe Schmidt they knew? And it turns out that it was. And that's the prologue, right? So I kind of got that far and I kind of went, yeah, I think I'll put this aside. There's other things to be doing. Like, to be honest, I was surprised that he did a book in a way. His relationship with the print media in particular, I can't speak to the broadcast media, but certainly with the print media down the years would have been quite chilly, quite mixed, let's say, to say the very least. I think his own view of the media is I'd say overall is suspicious for a guy, I suppose.
Hostile at times?
Hostile. Having not been in regular sort of, I suppose, interaction with the guy, I'm just picking it up from the outside really as much as anything. But I would certainly say... In tandem with a lot of managers, you see a lot across the sports, in those areas where their control isn't complete, they can be quite suspicious about what's going on here. How can I get a bit more of a handle on what's going on here? And I think there was a little bit of an element of that with him as Irish coach, which led me to think, I see the book, like, what's going to be in here? Because, I mean, he's going to want to, again, control the message, which is why I would assume that he wrote it himself. There's been a little bit about why he wrote it himself in the World Cup year and all that sort of thing. My own sense of that would have been that, I mean, he's an English teacher. So I think he would have had a reasonable, he would have probably backed himself to write something anyway in the first place. And also, if you look across sports columns, particularly GA columns, because they have day jobs, a share of those guys down the years have been teachers and they have written their own columns themselves. So I wouldn't be getting too uptight over him writing it himself, which has been sort of mentioned as a sort of a stick to beat him with. But the problem, if you don't employ a ghostwriter, you're essentially answering the questions that you're asking yourself, which is not really, it doesn't bode well. I mean, I put it in a very, the way I remember Mickey Hart saying, the Tyrone manager saying quite a while ago, a long time ago now, when he's imagining, we'll say, strategies for a match, right? And he's running the plans through his head. when your verbal, your internal monologue is entirely different to your external monologue. So if you're going through your head, if you're Joe Schmidt writing your book on, yeah, I was born in such a blah, 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 that's grand. But if you say these things out, if you say them to someone else, well, then someone else might just ask you something that you mightn't have even thought of. Either not so much picking a hole, but just taking you down another angle. And it's not that, I mean, a few people have said, well, even if you had a ghostwriter, it wouldn't have made any difference because Joe's such a control guy that it would have been the same. But at least it would have exposed Joe to the notion of maybe going off in different directions and different tangents and giving a little more of himself without giving himself away, but just giving a little more to the reader. I think that, it's like, obviously it's a huge opportunity lost. I think that's pretty obvious.
Okay, other rugby books. Warren Gatland was in the studio only about a month ago, and he has his autobiography, Pride and Passion. We're going to play an extract from that in a moment. But you enjoyed this, Niamh.
Yeah, I did. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really well written. I thought...
it was written with a ghostwriter as well, Chris Hewitt.
No, I just think that there was a really good flow to it. He's had a really tough road to being, you know, such a very good coach and a very successful one, and not one that many people have always believed in him. And it's honest. Like, you know, he's obviously had a family, you know, stressing family issues, and that's a huge theme, the family.
Well, actually, we're going to play an extract from this because I thought this was one of the most powerful extracts from the book. He wrote about the death of his firstborn child, and this actually happened. The child was born in Galway. Yeah. They brought the child home to Northern New Zealand, where she died when she was 4 months old. So let's hear a little bit of what he told us here on The Last Word about how that tragedy shaped him as a person.
It was tough. Lots made sometimes about my relationship with Ireland, but I need to put everyone straight because I'm so indebted to Ireland for the opportunities they gave me, the great friends that I have here. And when Shauna was born, that sort of typified what the Irish are like. And the first thing they said to me is that we were coming through playoff stages with Galwegians trying to get promoted, and they said, you've just got to go home. You know, it's more important to be home with your family. And that really struck, really resonated with me in terms of the people here. And obviously, you know, they'd made a significant amount of investment in having me here and to get the club promoted. But when it came to it, you know, family was more important. So, that definitely had an impact on me.
Shauna was born with spina bifida.
That's right.
And she lived for how long?
4 months, just under 4 months. So, you know, we could have gone through all the surgery and stuff, and, you know, it was serious. I mean, you imagine that, you know, how small a baby is, and the sort of, so she had a, obviously with the spine, that she born with a hole in her back, and it was probably the size of a fist. So it was, you know, significant in terms of, you know, how severe the lesion was on her back. And just before she passed away, that lesion had closed up, and my wife Trudy was amazing in the way that she looked after her and stuff. And often with, you know, things like that, I mean, you can go two ways. You can either, it can take your toll on a marriage, and you can, and often people separate afterwards with things like that, or it can bring you closer and tighter. And for us, it was definitely the latter. You know, it really brought us closer together as a couple and as a family.
Niamh, that interview is one of the highlights of the year for me. We actually have it. It's about a half an hour long up as a podcast. One thing I found about Warren Gatland is when you meet him in person, he's way more likable than you actually expect him to be from all these press conference appearances. He's a really engaging character.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously that's an incredibly powerful piece, but that's just as powerful on print when you read the book. And not to take away from him, but I'd read Sam Warburton's as well, and he's the exact same in that he speaks really highly of Warren in the book about how family becomes first, and how Warren gets the best out of his players by looking after the person. And
a lot of Dublin footballers would say the same about Jim Gavin's influence on them and the five in a row.
Yeah, 100%. And I think when you're coaching that level or managing that level, it's about how you manage people as opposed to the tactics or the players a lot of the time, because everybody's as good as everybody else in terms of preparation, and they're the elite. How to get the best out of people is often happens to how you manage them. And I think that came across really well in Warren's back book. I really, really enjoyed it, actually. It's a really powerful
story. It was great on the Irish stuff as well, about his time when he came over originally with Galwegians, the Connacht coaching job Ireland. But sometimes perhaps you forget,
that
he was such a big figure.
As a child, my dad would play for Galway, and I remember seeing him in and around the place. And I've always found it a bit peculiar how we were so quick to get rid of him. And
and he addresses that in the book as well.
That was the politics of the time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But like he was, and I remember him that time. Like, he was a good old character when he was in Ireland as well. You know, there was a bit about him. I think was he the originator of the 15 man line out at one point?
Well, the 13 man, somebody had one to throw it in.
But he was always an interesting character, and it's true. Like, for a certain generation of people, they might only remember Warren Gatland for the Lions and for Wales, but there's this whole other. There's this whole other aspect to him. And people over players, if you like, kind of attitude, as you were saying, Eve, like, I mean, when you have, you know, athletes at that elite level, it's all about kind of trying to connect with them on another level. And it's great to see that reflected in the book as well, because sport has changed so much and players and what's required has changed so much. It's still nice to have that element of humanity in books to keep you moving forward. I think that's important. It's important to get that sense of what it's like to be a sports player, what they face from day to day. But it's important to have that humanity. And again, you know, maybe that's lacking in the Schmidt book a little bit.
Well, I want to get away from rugby books, but just any other rugby books you want to mention?
Well, obviously we have Jamie Heaslip. All in.
I just said, you were not tired to do this on the basis that you had to give a mention to that.
I should just read the prepared statement I was given. a thumping good read. That should be read, obviously. But no, it was...
There's just one thing I want to address about that, because there has been a little bit of controversy about that. And I would concede that we made a couple of small factual mistakes in the book, made at a remove of 13 years, and I would say in good faith, which I believe doesn't diminish the integrity of the story that Jamie was telling. He got the dates of a drug test he took wrong by 2 months, and he mixed up a little bit of the process by which he was cleared of what we described as a potentially failed drugs test. And it was a matter of great concern to him at the time it happened, which is why we included it in the book. But with the passage of time, he mixed up some of the details and he didn't have access to the necessary documents from the time when we were completing the book. So Paul Kimmage made an issue of this after publication. Jamie went to Sports Ireland, and fortunately it was able to supply the documents to establish that Jamie was been truthful in his overall recollection, and that the explanation of what had happened as given in the book was essentially correct and was honest. And we'll make some small corrections for the paperback edition of the book in the new year. Yeah. So I'm trying to put that one to rest.
Did it sort of affect the perception of the book a bit?
I think it did, to a degree, yeah.
Yeah.
I was halfway through it when the Paul Kimmage article came out. And it didn't really affect my opinion of the book, to be honest. I thought it was good in that, you know, you had to admire how diligent he was in terms of being able to get the best out of himself. Literally did everything and anything he could to make sure that he recovered well, that he managed to be able, at that level, to be able to train day in, day out for so long, never miss any matches. I thought it was really interesting, his view on how the business versus sport perception. And he's the first kind of player
Heard anyone really go that way with it.
He's the first person to come out about that, and how basically you are only a number. And like, they all probably think it, but not many of them would say it. So fair play to him for saying it. I thought he was, you know, it was a different route to go through.
But he was keen to do that. I think that was the reason why he asked me to work with him on the book, was to sort of explore that particular avenue and route.
It's just that he constantly spoke about how the game didn't define him as a player. And I think he felt that the perception people had of him was, you know, not as chummy as how they view other players. But he keeps reminding us in the book, and I didn't like that. I just would have preferred for him to say, look, it didn't define me, whatever, and I had other interests. But I felt that he went on about it a lot.
I thought first of all, actually, just in terms of the drug issue, I think it's good that it's been clarified. I think it was a necessary exercise for everybody to clarify. I think it's important for Heaslip. I think it's important for the book. I think it's important for the sport as well to be seen to be absolutely straight down the line with this stuff. And, you know, for things to be clarified if they need to be clarified. In terms of the book itself, it was an interesting one, in the sense that, again, I go back to this word vulnerable, right? Because I was kind of thinking, even with the Schmidt thing to a lesser extent, and I accept I haven't read it, but just from the extracts and stuff, but this kind of slight reluctance to be seen to be vulnerable, I thought was interesting, because a lot of the best autobiographies that we've read this year are people like Warren Gatland, who have put it out there, Owen Larkin, who've all laid it out there. I got the sense with the Heaslip book that he had this very, very firm view that it was going to be, that it was going to be an expression of himself and through his job, and this is my job, and I'm going to explain to you what it's like to be an elite athlete. But even within that, at times, I thought he kind of held back a small little bit.
But at the same time, as he would have said to me, and I hope I'm not saying anything out of turn here in saying this, but as he did say, he's had a really enjoyable, good upbringing life. He hasn't had the difficulties that many of the other people who have written some of the best sports books have. He said he couldn't actually turn around and say that he had some sort of real traumas.
But that's fine. Like, I mean, we're not looking for trauma either. I mean, sometimes, you know, you get weary actually sometimes in sports books, especially the kind of mediocre ones where they're trying to just drum up tragedy at all turns. What has struck me was that there was this constant sort of almost like a very light barrier between you and Jamie.
Sometimes I wonder, did he actually like it?
Yeah,
being a rugby player?
It sounded extremely stressful.
Like, do you know what I mean? That kind of came across a bit. Did he actually enjoy being a rugby player? Because he seemed...
Well, he says in the book he moved from being a sport that he enjoyed with his friends when he was playing in Trinity to being a job when he was playing for Leinster and
It just came across that he viewed that to a huge amount. And I do agree with Michael that it did come across that he was a very stressful job at times. We forget that. We just think that they're all... Shouldn't they great? They're training full time.
And what
you
I think,
the person
think,
behind it.
What I think was really interesting as well, and if you could obviously speak to this, like, is the amount of information you have to carry as a professional rugby player, right? And like, if you think about it, right, you're going out, and there's one part of your brain is going, "I'm going to smash the bejesus out of these guys," right? But there's another logical part of your brain that has to work through
with all the game plans going through it, and you're having to remember in every different position along the pitch, two and three different options that might be called.
Yeah.
I mean, you need almost like a PhD to actually remember some of the stuff.
It's just an extraordinary split mind that you have to have. I'm sure obviously you would have experienced that.
Yeah, absolutely. I did enjoy it. I thought it was a good read.
Yeah.
Sam Warburton, did you like the Sam
Loved
Warburton
it.
Book? Did you?
Yeah. No, I could relate to it. There was lots of injuries like mine. and you know what I really found really enjoyable? Apart from, he had no pictures in his book. He had extracts of leadership qualities. So there was six leadership qualities in the book, which I thought were really good. So he had like three or four pages that were grey.
Right.
And just what he felt was good in leadership things. I thought it was a really good book.
We're going through our sports books of the year with Niamh Briggs, a former Irish rugby international, and Michael Foley, sports writer with the Sunday Times. Before we hear from them, I want to play a little bit of Owen Larkin, who wrote Camouflage, a book which deals with his battle with depression. And we're going to hear in this extract the call from Brian Cody that changed his life. In this particular extract, we hear how his wife Anne had tried to speak to him on numerous occasions and encouraged him to get help, but he couldn't accept that he had a problem.
For years previously, she had said, "You're depressed, Owen, you need to go to the doctor." And I had went to the doctor, you know, really to get her off me back, not that I was accepting things. And I went in and, you know, I just didn't acknowledge it. But in fairness, that morning when Brian Cody rang me and I was burst out into tears, she walked in and, you know, she couldn't believe I was in tears. I'd say she had seen me cry once and that was probably it.
And it was probably something to do with hurling and losing a match.
Definitely was. And she came in to Tadhg with me. She told the whole story to Tadhg. I didn't say anything. And Tadhg just normalised the conversation, asked me a couple of questions. I answered them. And he prescribed me with a bit of medication, like he would the sore throat. But in fairness, he was very understanding. He made it, you know, he made it normal. And the fact that he made it normal really made me feel at ease. And you know, it made me feel like I was after lifting people's feet off my shoulder, you know.
Yeah, but then
again,
what has to be done after that? Because it isn't simply a case of just a prescription of a few tablets. We diagnosed it, so go away now, you'll be grand, is it?
Yeah. No, it's not, no. And I went to a counsellor and I spoke to the counsellor for probably 3 or 4 months after, once or twice a week. But, you know, I think the first thing is you need to accept that you have a problem, that there's something wrong with you. And then obviously the next problem is, you know, how do you cope with it if this does come down the road again? And I think that's why I developed...
How do you cope now?
Well, I can see the triggers now, you know, if I'm feeling bad or if I'm, you know, feeling depressed or, you know, I say, you know, why am I feeling like this? I shouldn't be feeling like this. And usually I can get back to, you know, you haven't taken your medication for 3 days or this is after happening or that's after happening. And then I realise, you know, today might be a bad day, but tomorrow will be a good day.
Okay, both of you have picked this book, Camouflage, by Owen Larkin, another of the Kilkenny hurlers to have written the book, and they've all shown themselves to have great personalities, which perhaps when they were playing they were not allowed to show as much by Ryan Godey.
Well, there you go. That's it. When they take the helmet off, they're different men. But like, yeah, and I mean, you know, it is interesting that the greatest hurling team of all time has delivered a variety of different characters who are all able to pull together to be the greatest team of all time, you know, with different, various different shades to them. But this book, I think, for people, despite the fact he won 8 All-Ireland medals, and I mean, he was one of the most important players on that team, I would imagine that if people were making a list of Kilkenny hurlers to do a book, I don't think Owen Larkin would have been top, but he gives it everything, exactly as he would as a hurler. He leaves it all on the field here, and you can see, I mean, quite apart from his battle with depression and dealing with his mental health issues so well, you can see through the book why he was successful in a Cody regime. He's got that hardness, you know.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Actually, I think I read this in about a day and a half. I thought it was excellent. It's just really honest and refreshing, and it's really important, I think, now, the message that it sends across, and like one simple line from Cody, and you know, it makes the world a difference to him. And he's spoken about, had Cody not said that to him, he doesn't know where he'd be. I loved the fact that he speaks about his club as well. You know, GAA is real parochial, and when you're winning All Ireland with Kilkenny and winning so many of them, you can kind of forget in terms of the club scene. And he refers back to the club all the time, how it made him, the legends that were there, the relationship with his dad. And you can still see he's really driven, and the standards that he got from Kilkenny tries to implement into his club. And I really enjoyed that part.
The aspect as well, I mean, he was a soldier for most of his hurling career, and it's interesting. I mean, you had a situation at one point of the year there where Conor Fennelly and Urkel Kenny Hurler did some interviews kind of around sort of the difficulties of being a soldier, which Larkin kind of knocks back, but at the same time he's not a soldier anymore, and that transition, I suppose, from that lifestyle to kind of living, and he also didn't do a leaving cert and kind of coming back and accomplishing that for himself. It's a really honest book, and what I liked as well, actually, just from a kind of a, I'm not getting too boring about it now, but there's a kind of technical aspect to it. The chapters are done in months. So September, October, November, December, January. It's not done in a linear way. It's not one of these, and then in 2006 we won this match and then we went on and I got injured and so on. It moves back and forth. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't quite work. But overall, it's a really, really good, technically it's a great effort, and I mean, credit to Larkin, you know.
I want to say another book that you've picked out. Just want to stay in GAA, and this is one of my favourites in the year. But then again, both of us are from Cork. This is Adrian Russell's book on the team that did the Cork teams that did the double in 1990. So let's just hear, before we talk, a little bit of Adrian talking about the rivalry that the football team had with Meath.
Larry Tompkins, Owen Shefa, they kind of had to explain really what was coming on the tracks once they got out of Munster and faced this Meath team who were coming. They were probably a year ahead of Cork in their development at that stage. I think they had played Kerry in 86 in the semi-final. They lost to 87 and 88 in very controversial circumstances.
In a replay in 88, and Tommy Sugrue, the referee who you've interviewed for the book, got quite a lot of flack for the fact that he allowed a draw to Meath in the first game.
Yeah, Tommy was very generous with his time and his memories. The front of the page of the Examiner at that time was robbed. It was, you know, a late free that was perceived to be a soft free by Cork people and Cork management and players.
And Dr. Colin Murphy intervening to stop Billy Morgan getting to Tommy Sugrue as for the final whistle.
Exactly, yeah. And then in those days, you'll remember as well, it was different this year, it kind of came to mind, but if you refereed the first game, you did get the replay in those days, if you know what I mean. So Tommy Sugrue had to come up again. And the game
turned into one of the worst brawls of all time. And I mean, everyone remembers the 83 final between Dublin and Galway, with all the players sent off. But possibly the 88 replay, in which Gerry McEntee was sent off, was actually worse in its brutality and its viciousness.
Yeah, people remember it. As the players in particular, it was just kind of beyond the pale. And I think Billy Morgan makes the point in the book that it was probably his biggest mistake, telling his players to hold back.
That's just a bit of Corkman and me teeing up Adrian in relation to the 88 final. What I really enjoyed about this book was the way it built up to 1990, about the teams, the football team in particular, building up, and about Cork in that era.
Like, I mean, I flew through the book, obviously I'm going to, but it's kind of my, I was 13 going on 14 in 1990, so like it's right, I'm right in the market for this now. But it's it built up really, really well. I mean, the hurlers were at nothing that time. I mean, you know, relative to where they won in All-Ireland in 86, but they were really nowhere. I remember going to see them against Waterford in 89 and they lost in Replay, which was not acceptable at that time. Now it wouldn't have been an acceptable result at all. Came into 90 going nowhere. But what's great about it is it's just story after story. The characters are all there. I mean, some of the names and some of the stuff that they go through to get fit and get ready for matches and stuff. It's just, to be honest with you, to me, it's been a book that's been sticking out to be written for quite a while, and it's done really well. The stories are just great. It just keeps rolling and rolling and rolling, you know.
Okay, that was the double Adrian Russell. Okay, I'm just going to, because you've one more GAA one, you've got the official autobiography of Seamus Darby about that goal.
Yeah, it's just a nice straight up kind of, you know, we've heard the story told in books before, documentaries, wherever you want to go, and it's just good to have Darby's story of the goal, but also the life that came after it. It was quite an interesting life he had afterwards, and a lot of kind of maybe misperceptions of the man in terms of alcohol and stuff like that. He kind of gets to get his say on it in this book. It's decent.
Okay, one of the favourite interviews that we've had in recent months of Sports Stars was Michael Owen when he came in. It was the most enjoyable, unexpectedly unenjoyable interview, and yet the book reboot, Niamh, you hated it.
No, I actually cannot believe that he was enjoyable. Yeah, I had to put this down and go back to it numerous times because I found it really difficult to just, there didn't seem to be any personality to it as such. I found it really hard to put myself in his shoes at times. It was almost like at times, I get a premiership striker, he has to have a selfishness in him, but this was like Liverpool wouldn't take me back after I left, you know, for Real Madrid, and every year he tried to get back, and it's just, you know, how he was, I felt like it was like he was saying how much better he was than Newcastle United at the time, and I can see the fight before it even happened with Alan Shearer, and that was probably the best half chapter. No, I found it really difficult. I was really disappointed in it.
Let's just play a little bit of Michael Owen. This is when he was in. He admitted he only got his own bank account and took responsibility for his own finances at the age of 38, because prior to that, his mother took care of everything.
When you're the Golden Boot winner at 17, when you come back from a World Cup at 18 and then win another Golden Boot at 18, that's not normal. You know, in fact, it's never happened before.
Yeah.
So I've got nowhere, nobody knows what to say to me. Nobody, I'm having to fend for myself in many ways in terms of the mental side of things. So at that point, I said to my advisor, right, listen, I need to concentrate solely on football. Mum, you do all the, you know, because I can, obviously, if you can't trust your mum, you can't trust anyone. Mum, you sort of my life out. He'll sort everything else out, whether it's deals that are coming in or anything. And I'll focus on football. That was almost the unwritten rule. Now, that was life, and it never changed. I mean, yes, I knew how to draw money out the bank. Yes, I knew how to use a credit card. But paying, you know, an electricity bill and things like that, my mum used to just take care of everything like that for me. And you know what? It is laughable. And people do say, oh, these footballers, they're pandered to and everything else. And I suppose they are in many ways. But some people will also say, well, fair play. You know, he's a very much a family man. If you can't trust your family, then you can't trust anybody. And my mum was part of the team for a long time, and we all loved it. It's only now I'm sort of weaning herself away, and I'm taking a bit more control.
You should have seen the way Niamh Briggs was rolling her eyes again listening to that. You just do that like Michael Owen.
I'm trying to imagine how you were rolling your eyes at the time.
I was a huge fan of him growing up because he was only a few years older than me, and you could really relate to him. But I was just so disappointed. You wanted to know more about professional soccer, the personal side. And I went from that to Richard Sadler's book, and there was just no comparison.
I'm going mad that we're running out of time. We may not get to mention everything we wanted to. So let's quickly get to what both Niamh and myself regard as the book of the year, Richie Sadlier's Recovering.
Yeah, unbelievable. Like, unputdownable, I would say. I read it in one day.
And so did I. It's superb.
Yeah, it was so good from the very start to the last page. You almost didn't want it to end. And that's very unusual for an autobiography. It was brilliant how he, you know, people often dream about being a professional soccer player. And then, you know, when you're there and your mind is in it and your body's given up, like, how difficult must that have been? And then you're only, like, in your early 20s.
And with, like, more money than sense.
Yeah, it was just, and like, horrific yet brilliant and inspiring, if that makes any sense, in every way. It was a really good book.
We also have a Richie Sadler podcast available for you to hear. We did an interview with him when the book came out. In this extract, he recalls going to visit his dad as a child in a treatment centre and thinking, I'm never going to be like that. I'm never going to be an alcoholic.
I remember being 10 years of age going to visit my dad in a treatment centre, and the house that my dad grew up in, my granny and my granddad, both were still alive at the time. They ran a pub in Limerick, and when we used to visit them, it was all the kind of the daily drinkers, the smelly ones, the ones that when you're a kid, you look at them and go, gee, what's wrong with that woman or what's wrong with that man? So you're 8 or 9 or 10, and all the stuff that was going on in the house. And then we were told at the age of 10, this is because dad is an alcoholic and he's now in treatment. I remember thinking, right, well, I'm never going to be like that. I'm never going to drink. I'll certainly never be an alcoholic. Now, I've met loads of other people in recovery who've made the exact same promise for the exact same reasons. I'm not going to be like mum. I'm not going to be like dad. I'm not going to put my kids through what I've been through as a kid. Loads of people say, but those promises don't mean a thing if you're someone who ends up in any kind of an addiction. And I didn't start drinking. I was 2 years behind my mates. They were drinking cans and fields when they were 13 and 14. And I would go along and not drink. I'd say very little, but I would just be there because I was the sporty fella. I'd have matches at weekends. And then when I was 15, I started. Where I would say tell myself I had control is, you know, I wouldn't drink if I trained the next day, or I wouldn't drink if I had a match the next day. But when I started drinking, I had no off switch. And virtually 100% of my experiences of drinking, there would be patches of the previous night that I wouldn't remember. But because that happened from day one, I just thought, well, that's what happens. I remember I woke up in a police cell when I was 18 in London, and I had no recollection, like none. Not even a smidgen of a memory of what I did to get in there. And I remember, like, I was 18 going, okay, enough's enough now. I've been waking up now not knowing what I've been doing for quite a while. This is it. This is the end point. I'm going to rein it in. And then an hour later when I realised I was, you know, just drunk and disorderly, didn't say anything wrong, I was like, ah, Jesus, that was an overreaction. I'm grand.
Have you read it yet, Michael Pollard?
I've read stretches of it, yeah. It's excellent.
It's brilliant. It's the sports really book of the year. But what are the other ones? Because we have little time, that you would recommend.
I would say, my sports book of the year at the moment is In Sunshiner and Shadow by Don McRae, about boxing in Belfast during the Troubles. Jerry Story, the great trainer, Barry McGuigan, starts in Bloody Sunday 1972 and goes to 85. And it's just a brilliant exposition of life during the Troubles and how boxing helped to bring some vague kind of normality to life.
Donald was here talking about it earlier in the year. We plan to play a little bit of it tonight. Unfortunately, we don't have time, but again, the full podcast is available on the JFM website of Donald McRae on that. There's a rowing book you have to mention.
I have to mention this because, to my opinion, it's the best written Irish sports book this year. It's also the most beautiful looking Irish sports book. The cover is fantastic. It's called Something in the Water. It's by Kieran McCarthy. It's the story of Skibbereen Rowing Club, which are the Donovan brothers. But more importantly, it's about Dominic Casey and how that rowing club has built itself from nowhere to produce elite athletes, world champions, Olympic champions.
Yeah, Friggs, you've one more choice for us.
A Paddy Holohan, the hooligan. I thought it was brilliant.
Are you into MMA?
No, not even in the slightest. And when I got it, I was like, I cannot read this. And then it was almost as good as Richard Sadler's. It was a close second for me. Grew up with literally nothing by himself in Jobstown. Professional athlete, a business owner. If you're any way inclined as a child and you think, you know, children, I think they should read it. I think it's just way too many life lessons in it. I thought it was a really, really well-written book.
And one last one, just when we're mentioning MMA, Chaos is a Friend of Mine by Ewan McKenna on Conor McGregor, which isn't it's not a formulaic biography. If anybody knows Ewan's views on McGregor, they'll know it's a kind of trying to place McGregor within celebrity culture, within pop culture, and how 21st century perception of celebrity is feeding into the McGregor myth and how it all works out. It's interesting.
I should have said, we should have also mentioned Pat Nolan for his work on Owen Larkin's Camouflage and Dion Fanning in particular for his work on Richie Sadler's Recovering. Okay, listen, Niamh Briggs, Michael Foley, thank you so much for being with us here this evening.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.